Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 62 featuring Vlado. Again, of course, Vlado has been on a few times, but he's got a couple of cool things to talk about. I am sitting in the office in Sofia with Dinko. Dinko, how are you?
Hi, Chris. I'm fine, thanks.
Dinko has been very busy lately. Dinko, can you tell people what you do over at Chaos Group?
I'm helping some guys developing the awesome technology of the VR scans.
Yeah, the VR scans. So we just put out the VR scans website. The news came out. And you've been getting a lot of emails about people that are curious about this technology, right?
Yeah, enormous amount of emails were piling up over our heads.
Yeah.
And we've been struggling providing information to people what actually VR scan is.
Well, you know what? This podcast is going to help because Vlado speaks about the VR scans in this. So hopefully people will be able to get a little bit more information what's going on. The other things that are happening as well in this podcast is we talk a little bit about Vlado's build of a video game he did back in 1997. It's actually kind of an interesting history behind it. We talk about the new office. Are you going up to the fifth floor? Or are you going to stay down in the secret lab downstairs?
Yeah, we're going to spread over.
Yeah,
we're downstairs in the secret lab. We're here on the fourth floor, and also we're going to install some hardware on the fifth floor.
Wow! All right. Yeah. So V-Ray is getting into hardware business. This is kind of interesting. I like it. The other thing that we discuss on this podcast is obviously V-Ray. We love talking about V-Ray and about the new features that are going to be coming out in the V-Ray 3.3 for Maya. We have some really interesting discussions about the GPU. Get into that for a little bit. And the last part is Vlado's opinion about some V-Ray, some VR and real-time technology. So hopefully you guys will enjoy it, appreciate it. And all right, thanks a lot.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
As you saw, I went out with the guys last night.
Yep.
And we had a lot of beers and some rakia.
Okay.
But there was a story going around, and Vlago's going to be very upset that I told this story. But I told him I'm going to do it anyway. There's a story about you having done at the university. You entered a competition that you did for a game.
Yep.
And you made a game that pretty much looks like a Quake-type game. Am I correct? Or Doom-type game?
Doom-type thing, yeah.
Now, what year was this approximately?
So that was 1997?
97.
97.
Okay, so the computers were pretty old back then. I mean, or they were pretty underpowered.
They were older, yes.
Yeah, okay. And You built the whole thing from scratch, right?
Yep.
And you entered this as a competition for the school, and you won the competition, apparently.
Yes.
Okay. Now, is it also true that Peter gave you the prize for the competition?
Yes.
So Peter, the CEO of this company, gave you the prize for that competition. Yep. I guess that's where he found out about you through that.
Yeah, that game was the reason that he contacted me at all.
Okay.
And asked if we wanted to do things together.
Right. So now Blago also went to the same university as you did.
Yep.
And there was this story going around, because this competition, I guess, is still around. And there was a story going around that someone said, hey, there's a someone won a competition. No one knows what's going on this in this competition, because someone won a competition. They made some kind of a Doom game, but all they did is they took Doom and they replaced all the sprites in it.
Nope.
No. And he goes, this story has been going around for a while, and I think it's Vlado, and I think it's his story.
I have all the source code, and I can prove that it's not.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's written in the only programming language that I knew back then, except BASIC, was Turbo Pascal.
Turbo Pascal.
So the whole game was written in Pascal and a little bit of assembly language.
Right.
I didn't know C at all at that time.
Yeah.
And Doom sources are all C, so.
Right.
And that was also the reason the game was pretty slow, because Pascal didn't do any kind of optimizations at all.
Right.
But, and also the principle was totally different. Like Doom uses BSP trees and my game used portals and the Z buffer. So it was all completely different.
Wow.
Approach.
Well, I knew that you obviously wasn't you just replacing the sprites. And I don't think that Blago was claiming that, but he thinks that some people thought that it looked so good that people assumed it was actually just Doom with someone replacing the sprites.
No, well, actually, some of the textures, because I'm not an artist, like I couldn't paint textures.
Sure, sure.
So I did do screen grabs of Doom screens, and some of the textures I took from the Doom game.
Oh, so right.
It
was misleading.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I also had a lot of original textures.
They right. Looked,
and you could tell which were which. But anyway.
Yeah. It's an interesting story. And I think that obviously this story was going around in the university about this. And then Blago saw your YouTube channel. I guess the game gameplay is on the YouTube channel.
Yep.
Which I will put on the podcast. But I think that what's really funny is like, oh my God, the story is all wrong. Vlado wrote this. So there's a lot of that. That's true. That's pretty funny. All right. So I haven't been to Bulgaria in a couple of years, and things have been. You now have grown from 100 people that was here to 160 in 2 years.
Yeah, a few more people.
Taking up a new floor. You guys are going to go be upstairs as well.
Yep.
Are you excited about that?
I can work anywhere.
Yeah.
Back in the days, I used to sleep on the floor next to my desk.
Yeah.
So it's nice for the guys. It's nice to have a little bit more space. We're also getting these stand-up desks where you can, not everyone, but we're sort of, because I'm not convinced it's a good way to work, but we're just testing
it. You work standing up when you're in the LA office, though.
Yes, but I don't know whether I'd want to do it the whole time.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah. I saw a system which is basically sits on your desk and then it just raises and you can raise it
up.
Yeah,
no, this is an actual, it has electric motors and the whole desk goes up and down.
Yeah, yep.
It looks pretty cool, especially if you sit on the desk, you can sort of play with it.
You can make it a ride.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. That's really great. So having you guys on, and you're going to keep the half floor on the third floor, or are you guys going to move out of there?
It's funny because the original idea was that the developers would move to the fifth floor so that we'll have a little bit more space.
Mm-hmm.
But then the cloud team moved from the third floor to the fifth floor so that all the developers can be together.
Right.
And then some of the support guys will move with us. So everybody will move to the fifth floor. So we'll do the same thing again.
So why are the support guys are sort of integrating with the developers more to be more?
Yeah, we realize that the things that our QA guys are looking into are very, very similar to what the support guys are doing.
Right.
And we can make it might just make sense to make them all part of the same team. And we also have a very good connection between the developers and the QA guys, whereas the support guys were a little bit
out of the loop. Yeah.
And we think it will just work better if you rearrange things a little bit.
So QA guys are the quality assurance guys,
yes.
Right? So they're the ones that test the software, make sure it's working correctly.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. They do a good job.
Yeah.
Obviously not perfect, but
no,
we're trying.
Well, yeah. But obviously, there's always going to be stuff that you don't always catch.
Things are a lot better than they were before when we didn't have any QA guys.
Right. Yeah, no, my wife used to be a software system tester. That was her first job. She worked on database systems and actually one of her first big jobs. When I met her, she was doing the Y2K rollout because for some reason she learned Fortran. She knew some Fortran, and all those old database systems are all working in Fortran. Yep. Okay. Well, there's a couple things I want to go over. Obviously, since I got here to Bulgaria, we announced the VR scans, which is kind of a big deal. I've known about this for a while. There's been hints about it that we've given to people, and a few people have been trying it out and seeing what's going on. But why don't you give us a little bit of history about where that came about and how that that scanner has been developed?
It's been a very long project. We started maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
Yep.
It was Peter's idea.
Okay.
He went to Japan on a few business trips, visiting customers there, and there was obviously a need for some of our customers to be able to render very realistic materials.
Right.
They couldn't figure out a way to make them CG materials, like you have the Vuri material, bump maps, whatever. But it's just, there are some very weird materials out there.
Yeah.
Especially if you look at some types of fabric, they have multiple layers of threads going in different directions. There's a whole 3D structure in the material, and depending on how you look at it, it may look even different color.
Right.
So doing this in 3ds Max with materials that we had back then wasn't possible. So we were looking into ways to basically scan a material and make it render inside V-Ray.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that it was an odd project for us because we didn't know whether it's doable at all. Like, it looked doable, but we didn't know if it's going to work.
Sure.
We had no idea how to actually do that. We hadn't done any hardware stuff before.
Right.
All we've ever done is software. We basically just started thinking of different ways to go. And it was very fortunate for us that one of our 3D guys could actually build stuff.
Yeah, he could. Yeah,
it was. He's not not a professional hardware guy, but
sure,
he's very good with his hands.
Uh-huh.
So he could set up a small workshop and try different things. And Ivailo, the guy who wrote Phoenix.
Oh right, yeah.
Is very good at all kinds of physics stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he'd done hardware work before in his previous job. So he had some experience in getting specialized hardware and software to communicate.
Yep.
So he was basically the person who figured out all the software part.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of them worked together to build a prototype of the system. And at some point, it became obvious that it can be done.
Right.
But there were so many issues along the way.
Yeah.
Like it's not like software where you can, if there's a bug or something doesn't work, you just scratch it and start all over again. This is, you build stuff, and if it doesn't work, it takes a lot more time and effort to get something workable.
Right.
But it did work eventually. There were many issues with getting the right light sources, getting the right cameras, figuring the whole concept of the scanner, how to get the same material sample illuminated from different directions and photographed from different directions, and then rendering all of that. Dialing was an issue because we can't scan very large materials, so we had to figure out ways to deal with dialing.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, at some point, we got better and better at this.
Yep.
And we decided that we should go public with it.
Right. Well, it's obviously been under development for a while. And it's really cool. I mean, I got to see it finally firsthand and see how it works. And it's a process to get it out, but it's actually a lot pretty fairly automated. It's actually kind of nice that you just, you know, plop your material down, does this, and then obviously there's a But the results are pretty cool because it comes in, and what we should be clear is what this is, right? Because it's not a texture map, right?
No.
It's actual reflectance that you're actually calculating for every pixel, right?
It basically, the whole scanner takes a piece of the material and takes a lot of photographs of the same material under different lighting situations. Mm-hmm. And then it comes up with all of that goes into a file that V-Ray can then use to render it.
Right.
But there's no texture maps as such. There's no diffuse texture or normal maps or blur maps. It's not like it just captures the way the whole material reacts to light.
It basically, like, for every pixel of this capture, it has the it'll basically say it'll know how light reacts under any angle of light. Which is basically like a BRDF, except that the BRDF for every pixel is different.
It's like a texture of BRDFs,
right? And so it's really kind of cool because it's things that are fairly complex, like certain fabrics that are very hard to actually get right, is just there. You don't even have to think about it. You just scan it and then it'll render correctly.
It's amazing. I'm still surprised that whole thing works. Like, my involvement in the whole project is very minimal because I only have a little bit of input on the rendering part and integrating the shader with V-Ray. But so it's a surprise for me as well that everything came together and worked so well.
Well, that's really cool. I'm sure the people would be really happy to hear that, especially the guys that have been working on it for a while. But there's a few things that people should know about this. Obviously, you said, you know, there's some, we've got a second way to make it tile correctly, and it worked pretty well. Actually, I've seen some really good results with the tiling situation. But it also has an ability to, it's not necessarily editable in certain ways, obviously, right? Because it's not a texture map, et cetera. Yeah. And you basically, for most of the use cases that this would be useful for, would be for people who say, I want it to look exactly correct.
Yeah.
And you can put it exactly correctly in there. So it's so that's one thing that's important that people need to realize. So for people doing product design, they want to use that material. They scan that material and then they have that material.
Yes.
So it works really well for product design, car design, things of that nature. I think, to be honest, I think people in the fashion industry, I don't know how much CG is done in fashion, but I think that there's actually a lot of people are using Marvelous Designer to do cloth sims. So I'm sure that would be interesting as well. But what I also find is interesting is your thoughts about it. You know, everyone's like, well, this is not necessarily for visual effects, but at the same time, it's the best reference you can get.
Yes, that was my point. So it's probably not directly usable in the VFX situation, but if you get the scan material and you can make a CG material that looks similar, because for example, if you need to make something look red, and you know that it should look like velvet,
right?
But how red is red? Like, you need to have a point of reference,
right?
And people have been doing this either by just eyeballing it,
or looking at a photograph, and then trying to match the approximate lighting of the photograph, or you need an HDR of that exact environment, make sure it's all color calibrated.
But it's a difficult process. It's a lot simpler when you get the scan material in Max or in Maya, and then you know that you have to match it, and it's a lot easier.
Because the scan material is just the pre-order material, and it also, the other thing is, when you're looking at certain things like a velvet or whatever, you don't know how much of it is diffuse and which is specular, right? So that is something that becomes very clear when you're looking at it in the rendering. It's like, well, that's how much reflectivity I have on it.
Yeah.
So it's a really cool idea. But there are certain things you can do. You can blend it with other materials, right?
Yes, you can do blends. You can change the overall tint of the material.
Right, there's like a color gain availability, right? Yeah.
It's a... The cool thing is that if you want to do a regular V-Ray material out of this, it can probably be done. Once you are in a 3D application, you can do lots of things. Like you can illuminate the material from different directions. And you can sort of extract the maps that you need just by looking at the scan material inside of Max or Maya.
Okay.
So it can be a... It's like having the actual material inside.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I think there's a lot of things. What's always cool about, you know, stuff we do in V-Ray is sometimes we do these crazy new features or whatever, and people start using them in cases that we didn't think of. So I'm curious to see what people do with this.
Yeah, we'll see.
So we should explain a couple of other things. Right now, it's being we're offering a service to scan your material. So
yep.
If you have a material that you want to try out, they'd have to get in touch with. You can go to I think it's called V-Ray Scan or VRScans.com.
VRScans.com. Yeah.
Yeah. So go to VRScans.com and you can check out what's going on and contact us through there, and we'll get your material scanned and then you'll return your materials with a VR scan file.
Yep.
Now what's let's go in that file itself. People are going to say, well, if it has every condition of light and everything, how big is that file right now?
It depends on the amount of details in material itself.
Okay.
Simpler materials that don't have a lot of texture in them could be about 70, 80 megabytes.
Mm-hmm.
And more complicated materials, when you have clear patterns and they don't compress very well, they could be up to 300 megabytes.
Right. I think Dinko says like 300 is the most you can expect out of any material now. Which is, you know, that's a lot. But if you have 10 materials in your scene, if you're doing a product and 10 materials, that's only using about 3 gigs. Yep. So it's not that bad.
It's not too bad, but there's really lots of information that's packed in that file.
Yeah. So a couple of other questions came up, which I think you could address. And one of them is obviously, what are some of the materials you can't necessarily scan? Obviously, this is mainly geared towards opaque materials at this point, right?
Yes. We can't do transparent or translucent materials right now.
Okay.
Things like subsurface scattering. We haven't, it requires a whole different approach, both to the rendering part and to the scanning part, and we haven't really looked into that yet.
Yep.
And we also can't do very, very reflective materials like perfect mirrors.
Right.
They don't work too well.
Yes. Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about the way light works, it's like, yeah, how am I going to scan something I can't see? But there are different things. I saw, didn't ICT do some way of scanning some sunglasses or something like that? But I forgot how they did that. They did something.
It's, well, if you know that it's glass, then you can make assumptions.
But right.
If you just have material that you don't know what it is, then it's not that easy.
Right. Okay, well, that was that's something that I think is pretty cool that people would be wanting to know about. But I want to talk about a couple other thing is V-Ray. So it's honestly one of the stuff we've done. We've done a lot of stuff in V-Ray. The new service pack is going to be coming up soon for Maya, right?
Yep.
How's that going?
So far, so good.
Yeah.
The builds, we'll start doing the builds tonight, actually, because they have to be ready by sometime tomorrow.
Okay.
But on the one hand, it's a little bit easier because some of the stuff we already rolled out as part of the Max service pack.
Okay.
Like the new variance-based sampling, different types of optimizations, all of that we put into the Max release. So it's kind of... We already know that it works and it's tested. But there's also a lot of Maya-specific things, like we rewrote the way the V-Ray proxies are displayed in the Maya viewports. We are now using direct GPU, direct commands for the GPU.
Okay, what does that mean?
It means basically before we built, in order to display the V-Ray proxy in the Maya viewport, we built a Maya mesh object, and then Maya takes it and displays it in the viewport.
Oh.
But this is a little bit slow because it has to go through many different API layers.
Mm-hmm.
So Autodesk added this possibility in Maya to draw geometry directly in the viewports. They implemented something called a GPU cache.
Okay.
And we they also give out the source code for that in the Maya dev kit. So we took the same approach for the Vray proxies.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that people should be able to display stuff and interact with the scenes and the viewports a lot faster than before.
It's faster, but are they more detailed? Because they used to have these sparse ways of looking at things before.
No, we also have the new Vray mesh preview modes where you can see a simplified version of the mesh, but it's a connected mesh, so you can see the shape.
Okay, as opposed to just a bunch of random triangles that
yes.
you're trying to figure
out. Yeah, it's better than it was.
Okay, that's cool. Well, that's good to know. What some other cool, besides obviously you said there's the variance based sampler is in there. I'm assuming that the new stochastic
Flakes material is in there, yes. Yeah. All the things that we did, the triplanar texture that we did for Max is also in Maya.
So what's the triplanar stuff? Tell me a little bit about that. How's that different from the normal Maya triplanar?
There's a little bit of blending between the three textures.
Okay.
With the Maya triplanar mold, it's just the switch from one texture to another is abrupt.
Is abrupt. Okay.
So if the textures don't tile very well, or they are very different, you get a hard edge.
Mm-hmm.
The triplanar texture avoids that problem, but it also has a bunch of options to randomize the mapping so that you can get nice variations if you apply the same texture across many objects.
Yeah.
Especially if you want to do things like rocks or anything that's like, you don't want them to look all the same.
No, right. I mean, it works really good for any kind of blobby shape of some kind. Yep. You want to apply a texture across the whole thing.
Yep.
Well, that's cool. And some of the other things that are Maya specific that are coming out?
Yeah, we are experimenting with a way to load a Vray scene file in the Maya viewport as one single object that you can then move around and instance and clone.
Like a proxy?
It is like a proxy, but it's a Vray scene file, so it contains everything. It can contain lights, materials, displacement, hair, particles, anything that you can output from any of the applications that support Vray scene export.
So you could export a Max scene file.
Yes, and then you can bring it in Maya as a separate object.
And wow.
It makes a lot of things easier. Like, for example, what people found very it's interesting workflow. If you take an next-gen geometry out of Maya and you export a Vray scene file, then you can bring it in without using next-gen at all. And
right.
People actually like that workflow because next-gen is a little bit difficult to work with.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can just take the baked Vray scene file out of Maya once, and then you can reuse it.
But how is it? It wouldn't be the same as doing just an alembic sequence of something?
Well, there's still the materials.
Oh, right. Of course.
Right. Materials, lights are all inside the Vray scene file. But yeah, the idea is similar. It's just the Vray scene is a lot more general, and you can do like the proxies were originally created for just one purpose, to store lots of geometry.
Mm-hmm.
And they've sort of expanded into other things, but there's still a lot of limitations and you can't really put anything into a proxy, whereas you can put anything into a Vray scene.
Okay. Now, is it just as efficient to do a Vray scene and just treat it like a proxy where you can clone it?
Yep.
Yeah. Is it just as efficient in terms of loading the way that a proxy was, or?
Well, it's the proxy has the on-demand loading thing, which the Vray scenes do not. But in many cases, it's not really that important.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
I mean, even with the proxies, most people just use them as a way to cache geometry just for render time. The part where Vray can load geometry on demand from proxies is actually a little bit secondary.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense. So let me see. What other things are going on in V-Ray? Can you say if anything else that's interesting that you guys are thinking about?
Well, this year we have a number of goals. To do first, we need to. There's still a bunch of optimizations that we want to do to make V-Ray faster in different situations. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of work in the last two service packs, but there's still more to be done.
Okay.
We also have plans for the GPU.
Yeah, of course we do.
In this service pack for Maya, people can choose the GPU render as a final frame renderer. Before, you could only use the GPU as an IPR render.
Right.
But a lot of people actually want to render their final sequences on the GPU.
Right.
So they can, like, we could do this in Max if you choose VRayArt as a production renderer. But mm-hmm. now we've added this possibility to Maya as well.
Okay, great.
And
is it just basically listed as a different renderer when you?
No, it's not a different renderer like in Max. It's just you have basically a drop down that tells V-Ray whether to render on the CPU or GPU.
Oh, right. And does it do OpenCL and CUDA?
Yes, yeah, OpenCL and CUDA.
Great.
And then we have a bunch of things related to that. Like, we need to finish the work that we did on delayed on-demand loading of textures.
Mm-hmm.
We need to add a bunch of render elements to the GPU
mm-hmm.
and basically make it as close to the original V-Ray as we can.
Yeah.
There's a long list of features that... and we also have to finish our work on the multi-kernel version
right.
of the GPU render. So, yeah, that's a lot of work for this year. And generally, we want to improve the stability and the interactiveness of VRayRT, both in Max and in Maya.
Right.
It can be a lot better than it is now, and it's one of the goals for this year.
Right. So that sounds like we're putting a lot of effort on the GPU side. I know there's at least two or three developers on the GPU, right?
Yep, four.
Four.
Yep.
And so GPU, are we seeing a bigger demand in people looking at our GPU renderer at this point?
It gets more and more popular.
Yeah.
It's still not like a complete replacement for the production V-Ray that we've had so far. And we're working on both, right? So the GPU is progressing and getting more features, but the CPU render is also being optimized and getting faster.
Right.
So they're kind of both moving forward. It's not like we're giving up on one of them to focus on the other.
Right. No, I don't think, definitely not. I mean, with the amount of developers we have plenty of time to focus on both at the same time. But it's really kind of interesting to see how much more growth is happening on the GPU. And I think that what was cool is, you know, we were able to see a version of Construct, and I know people are going to say, can I see it too? But it's not ready for the general public. But it was really cool to see how good that renderer looks, you know, and the fact that we know that those frames were probably about, you know, 5 minutes a frame. Well, on the VCA.
Yes.
But it's still 5 minutes. It's still 5 minutes a frame, which is incredible, you know, and to see that level of quality being done and looks so clean, looks incredible to me, especially with the amount of detail we're putting in, the amount of textures that were in that system, and the fact that everything is done in camera, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was interesting to me, and I think this is one of my takeaways from Construct. Obviously, I think it's really, really beautiful. But I think one of the reasons it's really, really beautiful is because Kevin Nate did such an effort to make it be done, make it get a workflow that acted like real filmmaking. So he put real motion capture in there. The motion capture was really well done. I don't know what magic they have in terms of the stuff at Blur, but their motion capture artists, and they are artists, do a really good job of getting very good data and cleaning it up really well. Then the other thing is, he shot it, he moved the camera around, he motion captured that, and he moved it around very naturally, but also added the exact physical lensing that we would have and rendered all the correct depth of field. And mm-hmm. and it looked, that's, I think, and then of course the correct lighting with V-Ray, but that's what I think made it look so real. That those cameras felt like they were really in the scene. They were really, really well done.
Yep, it turned out really well. Even with the Phoenix part, that was
painful.
Got a lot of headaches, yeah. But it worked out.
Yeah, the Phoenix part was a bit of a headache because we were just there was a bunch of things that weren't quite working right. But that was 2 years ago. We should also note that. But it was, I think it turned out really, really well. I think that Kevin's got an amazing animation out there, and hopefully he will be releasing it to the public at some time soon. But it's just the fact that it looks as clean as it does, and as nice as it does, is because he made his goal. I think his goal was to make it look like real cinema. And I think the GPU being able to do everything in camera correctly with the correct lenses, I think freed him up to not even think about it. Just done.
Yeah. It was an easy project.
It wasn't easy.
In terms of rendering.
Yes. It did take him 2 years to do it, but it has nothing to do with rendering. just so we know. And you know, what's really cool. I was talking to Boris about it. Boris has a very, very soft spot for it. I know he worked his ass off on that then, but he said it's the first time that, Cloud was really sort of, V-Ray Cloud was sort of being put to the test on certain things.
Yeah, that's why Boris's team wrote a whole new job manager for the GPU cluster that we used.
Right. Yeah. It was kind of interesting because we were, just so people understand, when we were working on Construct, we had access to the VCAs because NVIDIA was super nice to give us access to the VCAs, but we didn't have a job manager to render to the VCAs. So Boris was like, "I'll write one," and it all works inside of a browser.
Yep.
So it was pretty cool, and I know that that's sort of the start, and he's continuing to develop that now.
Yeah,
right?
It actually, the ideas that they developed then are now getting into the version 2.0 of the cloud.
Yeah. Which I will be talking to him more about cloud tomorrow, so I'm not going to spoil him too much about that. I want to make sure we don't cross the some of the stuff. So did you know, by the way, that of all the podcasts that we have, that yours is still the number one podcast, the number one downloaded podcast? Nope. So it'll be it's pretty funny. I think there's probably about 14,000 downloads. So that's one of our highest rated podcasts.
Cool. Well, I don't know. Did I say anything that important?
Yes, you did. You did. You gave me the best answer to what's the difference between biased and unbiased. Okay. That was a good one because there's still very, very misleading information about unbiased. But anyway, it was really kind of cool. And what was nice, you know, let me go back to like 2 years ago when I first came here and I was talking to the office. I noticed that people were very, very shy, didn't say much, et cetera. This time when I came in, everyone was like, "Hey, Chris!" And they were all extremely happy.
They know you.
They know me now. Yeah. And then, you know, when I was getting my talk to people, sort of showing about what's going on in labs, I could just sense them being much more interactive with me, which felt great.
Well, you've been around for a while. You know a lot of them. You've worked with a lot of those people. So.
Yeah. It's nice. It feels like home to me, which is nice. So it felt really, really cool to be able to be around those guys and be able to hang out with them. So that's been something I really like. All right. I wanted to ask you a couple things. I don't know if you're interested in talking about it, but we can. About VR. This is a subject that's happening a lot right now. What are some of your thoughts on this? Because something... It's a very interesting article that came out that I saw today, but it was based on a keynote at the Vision Summit, which is a conference I went to, and I actually was there at the keynote.
Uh-huh.
And it was the CEO of Unity talking about the fact that he thinks that VR is incredible, but it's not going to have the linear rise that everyone in the press assumes. It's going to have more of an exponential rise where it's going to be very early now and get more and more and more later. And that if you do that graph where you have a linear rise and a exponential rise that happens underneath it, there's a gap, and he calls it the gap of expectation, that or gap of disappointment. That's what he calls it.
Right.
So that the he thinks that the press is going to start saying, well, VR sucks because it's not what they assumed it would be at a certain point. Where do you think, what is your opinion about the sort of the industry of VR at this point that you feel comfortable saying?
I'm a skeptical person by nature.
Yes.
So, and I'm a little bit skeptical about VR as well. That has never stopped me of doing stuff. Like, I was skeptical about GPUs as well in the beginning, but
yeah.
But
and yet we have one of the earliest. We have one of the earliest GPU runners out there.
So we are. That doesn't stop me from looking into things. But I think that with VR, it's really not going to be a very fast adoption. There are a number of reasons for that, but. And one of them is that there's still, except for the Gear VR and the Google Cardboard, there's not an actual device out yet.
Right. Supposedly in a few weeks, people will start getting their Oculuses. Yes.
Yeah. But it took so long for this, and there was such a huge hype.
Yes.
During this time when things were being developed.
Yep.
That many people may end up being slightly disappointed.
Yeah.
And also there's so many things going on in VR, people trying different approaches to stuff. Some of them will fail.
Yeah.
And we don't know which ones.
No, of course not.
So it's going to be an interesting time. So it will take a couple of years until things settle and become more widely accepted.
That's
my opinion. And also, the whole approach with VR, it requires you to think in a different way. Like, we had a question at the CG Squared event last year. Somebody asked, how should filmmakers approach VR? And I think that it's just not possible to do it in the traditional way, because like when you have a screen and people look at that screen and you sort of know what they will see.
Yeah.
But if you try to do the same thing in a VR situation, it doesn't work because you look everywhere else.
Right.
Except for the place you're supposed to.
Yeah.
And it's happened to me a number of times. Like, every time I've seen a VR video, I was really looking around at the environment and missing the action.
Right, right, right.
So how do you fix that? It's just going to require a whole different approach than what people are used to. And there will be trials and errors to get things right.
It's true. There's one of the other thing that was very interesting to me at the talk. A lot of the people out there, even Palmer Luckey from Oculus, from the founders of Oculus, who's I found out is 23 years old, makes me really feel old. So anyway, he was saying one of the biggest problems in VR right now is content. There's so much hype about it, but the content's actually severely lacking, and there's not a lot of content is not necessarily good, because most of it is technology demos, right?
Yes.
And technology demos are not necessarily driven by creative content, right? And so he's saying, make good content and you'll be surprised how much things will happen. Now, the other thing is people just use VR as a term of something they need, not knowing anything of what it actually does. Like, when there was someone that said, oh, Kevin, you're doing Construct, are you going to make a VR version? It's like, why would you? It's a story that works this way. Why would you make a VR version of that?
Yeah, that's like Kevin actually did a 360 video of one of the fight scenes.
He did that, but that's a fight scene. That's different. That's a way for you to sort of be in the middle of the fight and see what that would be like.
Yes, but half the time I was looking out the window.
So it's true.
Again, it's
right. Right. You're looking at them. It's like, I wonder what's going on outside. You know, someone's fighting behind you. Yeah. But I think this is definitely something, the digital film guys that I'm working with, these are things that we're experimenting with. It's like, so what happens when you actually do this? There's some really interesting people that I met at that Vision Summit that can help me answer some of these questions. But what's also interesting was some of the numbers I heard in terms of startups in this area. Because last October, there was 800 new companies, VR companies, that have started in the last 3 years. 800 VR companies. That's at the Vision Summit, that number, and this is since October till now, which is January, there's now 2,200 companies that have started up in VR.
Wow.
Everyone is getting involved. Everyone's doing this. But I think it sounds to me like a lot of those companies, they're all about trying to get venture capital right now. It's a race to get money in a field.
There's that, unfortunate.
And there's the hype about it. Hype.
Well, a lot of those things will fail, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, but I know. No, of course not. Of course, the cream rises to the top is what they always say. But I'd like to see some of that success. I'm worried that the massive failure of it will maybe kill people's hope about what VR is going to be.
No, I'm not that skeptical.
Okay. Well, someone was saying, like, well, do you think VR is going to dead when they all fail? And I was like, no, because the .com crash didn't kill the internet, right?
Right. No, the concept is very good. Like, people can see practical applications.
Yeah.
Also in entertainment. So it's definitely, it has a future.
Yeah.
It's just not going to be maybe the explosive future that people hope for.
Right. I think there's one of the things, the takeaways, and I thought this was a pretty good thing to do from the Unity CEO. He said, lower people's expectations so that we have time to catch up to where they need to be.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there are lots of still problems to solve. Like, resolution is one. Things are still pretty low res.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of hardware catch up that needs to be done too now, right?
Yeah. Also dealing with motion sickness and making things as comfortable as possible.
Not bumping into furniture.
Yeah. So they will be solved, all these problems, eventually. Just takes a little bit more time.
Yeah, it's true. I think it's really interesting, but honestly, I've got some great, I wrote that guide to VR, which ended up being pretty cool. And I've gotten some feedback, an architecture firm that was a customer of ours, and they came up to me and they said, ever since we took the guide and started doing cube map renders out of it, half of our renders are VR renders, because now that people have seen how you can actually look around a space instead of just looking at a rendering,
yep,
it's solved a lot of their questions.
Yeah, it's really so much better than just flat pictures.
Yeah, yeah. Did you saw the bank stuff that we did, right, on the Gear VR? Have you seen it?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, the library and the church end up being really, really cool.
Really gives you a much better idea of the space and how things are positioned related to one another.
Yeah.
How big things are.
Yeah, you can see, like, oh, that's how big that desk is. Or even, you know, you can do a rendering of a church, let's say, and you just make a really wide lens to try to see as much as possible. But if you put it in VR, now you can look up and say, oh, that's how tall the ceiling is.
Exactly.
So it really, really does help in that situation. And it's been really kind of interesting to see how people are using it, because I just think it's really cool. And when I first actually started working with the library, with Bertrand, and he said, I don't really know anything about VR, but yeah, sure, you can take my scene and clean it up or whatever you need to do the renderings. And so we'd worked on it with Daniel Buck, and then he got the rendering back and he said, someone gave me a cardboard so I could check this out. Oh my God, this has changed everything for me. Yep. I realized how much more I can do it. And we were joking about it with Corey about how it changes the way that you think about rendering, because in architecture rendering, you would normally just go as far into the corner as possible to the rendering to get the room there. But now in VR, you want to actually be in the middle so you can turn around and experience the whole thing.
Yep.
So it's really kind of a different way of...
So the concept is great. It's definitely useful, especially when positional tracking gets into the whole picture as well, because just cube maps are good, but ideally you'd be able to
walk around as well.
Well, at least to some extent.
Yeah.
So that's going to be even more useful. And then there's, of course, the final part where you can render things in real time and walk anywhere you want.
Sure, sure. And so that brings up two questions for me. So if you're thinking about the somewhat looking around, right, like you're saying, obviously a lot of people are looking at different solutions. There's been a lot of talk about light field rendering. What are some of your thoughts on light field or light field in general, be it rendered or captured?
Well, it's one of those things where I haven't really seen a working solution,
right,
myself. Like I've seen other things that people have done, like the Nozzle guys, so I know that their solution works.
Right.
It's out there.
Yeah.
Light fields have a number of technical difficulties with the amount of data that's needed.
Yep.
To capture a full light field, and you need to store it, and then the playback, you have to be able to reproduce an image like 90 frames per second.
Yep.
So these are all challenges that they will probably be solved one way or another.
Yeah.
So things will get there. But there's also the other part, the real-time part, where you just have a game engine rendering at real-time frame rates.
Mm-hmm.
That's also going to be useful. That part also doesn't go away.
Yeah. Yeah, but the real time stuff can only be stuff that's CG, right?
Yes.
Light field is trying to attempt to actually do something that's in the real world.
It's just the huge amount of data that needs to be processed. Yeah, it's like the scan materials a little bit, because they also try to store a lot of information about the way light interacts with a physical object.
Right.
So it's, to some extent, it's kind of similar.
Right, yeah. Instead of looking at every lighting condition, you're looking at it every position that your head could be in, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess it does get a lot more complicated. But, yeah, it was pretty interesting. I did see the Nozzle demo when I was at FMX last year.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty interesting as well. All right. And then what about real time? What about your concept on real time? A lot of people are talking about how, you know, real time is going to kill offline rendering, and I actually think that they complement each other really well.
There's still like real time is getting better all the time.
Sure.
But there's still things that you can't do in a real time engine.
Right.
Even if you take like something as simple as a glass object where you have multiple rays bouncing around. You can fake it in the real-time engine, but it really looks fake.
Right.
And there's also a lot of pre-calculation that goes on. It's not like in a render, right now you just set up your objects, materials, and lights. You press render, and sometime later an image comes out.
Yep.
With game engines, it's still a little bit more complicated because you have to bake the lighting solution.
Yes.
Sometimes you have to go around the scene and place reflection probes.
Yeah.
You need to take care about shadow map sizes and stuff that ray tracing and offline renders forgot about a long time ago.
Yep.
All of that is still need to do it for real-time rendering. So it's not necessarily as easy to get an image out of a real-time render. If you go through all the trouble, of course you get real-time rendering, but it's a little bit more work to get there.
Yeah, but you can also use offline rendering to support that. In a sense, you could bake out the lighting out of an offline render.
Well, that's what people used to do before, right? They would bake out light maps.
Right.
And now the different game engines just include that part bundled with the game engine itself. So they also can bake light maps, but it's also just a simplified version of an offline render.
Right. So, but if you want to advance your rendering like V-Ray, you can just bake it out of V-Ray instead.
Yes, you can do that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, cool. Is there any other cool announcements you want to make, you can think of?
No, not really. For us, it's just a lot more work.
Yeah.
A lot of cool stuff that we want to try out.
Yeah. And you're going to be going to your new floor to try those out? Lenko told me it was going to be done this week, but I don't think that's going to happen.
No, it's Thursday. It took a while. You know, when you move a lot of people and they all have their own Like some people want to sit near a window, others don't want to sit near a window.
And Lenko had to listen to all of those and try to make those? Wow, that must have been hard for him.
It was. But hopefully most people are happy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was in the room the other day and he had all the white and red string that you guys make all the bracelets in March.
Yeah.
So can you tell people what that is? Because it's kind of cool to see all those things.
It's like a very, very old custom. It's like maybe centuries old.
Yeah.
Where people would take a white and a red thread and just make different ornaments out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Bracelets or necklaces.
Mm-hmm.
And they just give them to each other. So that, well, the idea was that it's done on the 1st of March,
and
supposedly spring comes.
Right.
So that people can stay healthy and happy throughout the whole year.
Yeah.
So it kind of stuck around.
Yes.
I know it's probably some pagan stuff that started many, many centuries ago and didn't die.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of cool because I remember when I came here last year, I must have been in March because everyone was wearing all of these bracelets and stuff. And I guess it's kind of like a friendship bracelet. So the more you have, the more friends you have.
Yes.
So it's very competitive.
Yes.
And then I guess at the end of March is when you guys take them off, when you put them up on the trees or something.
There are different, like, I've been told different stories. One, the original one was that you should take it off when you see a specific bird. I think it's called a stork.
Oh, stork, yeah.
So when you see one, that means that a spring is finally and firmly here and you can take the bracelet off and put it on a tree. Or the other thing that I've heard is that whenever you see a tree blossoming, you can put it on that one.
Yeah.
Or you can just keep it forever. Kind of.
Yeah. Well, cool. All right. So we're gonna wrap it up, but we've been trying to find a new sign off for the podcast because everyone, the developers especially, are telling me that buckets are a little old fashioned.
Yes, we use progressive sampling on buckets.
So letting the last bucket drop is not necessarily going to work. Blago was suggesting may the flop be with you.
Yes.
I thought that was good. Someone on the Twitter said you should always say, remember there's always Fresnel. Everything is Fresnel. I can do that as well. But if you have, do you have any suggestions of what you think a good sign-up would be?
I don't know. To me, it just never ends. Like, there's always the next thing. So.
The bug hunt continues.
Yes.
You had that on your sign-off at one point.
I had it, for a long time.
All right. Well, that sounds, unfortunately, I'm not going to say that because I don't want to talk about bugs. But I will I will explore the idea of may the flop be with you.
All right.
All right, guys. Thanks.